Last talk is Emeritus Professor Mark Edmonds from Archaeology at York. Mark had been chair in Archaeology at York for many years before that. I hadn't met Mark myself until today, though I had seen you in action at the dig at the Nessa Brodgar in Orkney, where we were lucky enough to visit in August of last year. And we saw some remarkable moments of scientific thinking in action as we were getting a tour, and Mark was working in extraordinary peace and concentration with his materials there in what I think was the last week of the dig there. Mark is the author of many books and articles in archaeology, some of which are remarkable pieces of scientific and artistic writing as well, and the overlap between the sciences and of archaeology and the arts and the crafts and of making as well as writing has been one of his concerns for many years. A lot of projects in poetry and craft have been collaborative projects that Mark has done with writers like Alan Garner, the novelist. Previously, Mark had also developed and ran a master's in landscape archaeology at Sheffield for years, which produced a lot of those who went on to sort of structure a lot of the work and the practice in British archaeology for years. I'm not going to say anything more about the work at Orkney, which we're going to hear about from Mark tonight. It's one of the most amazing places I have ever been to. Mark is going to talk to us tonight on building and belonging architecture and memory in Neolithic Orkney.
Thanks, John. Can you all hear me? Okay. Bonjour. Thank you very much for inviting me. That was an amazing talk. It was really interesting. And I was thinking about a comment you made about the woman on the bicycle saying, I kind of like it that the flowers fade. And about forgetting as actually part of the process of relating to an event. Anyway, in a way, that'll crop up again in what I'm going to talk about. But I'm going to take us off in a very different direction to look at some archaeological material from Neolithic Orkney, from the Orkney archipelago, and from 5,000 years ago. I approach working here and elsewhere as an archaeologist, as an artist, but I think that many of the themes that have animated the work that I do and my colleagues do actually chime, they resonate with quite a few of the things that we've heard about already today and we'll hear more of tomorrow. So I'm going to be concentrating on a period of about 5,000 years ago, a period we call the Neolithic. And I'm going to be talking about Les Orcades, the Orkney Islands. And you can almost see my house from there. Not quite. Looking south across mainland Orkney, which is just known in Orkney as mainland or the mainland, towards the hills of Hoy in the background, and then beyond that, going south, far too south, is Scotland. In terms of the Neolithic record in Orkney, the thing that people always fasten on is stone. And they fasten in particular on places like this, Skara Brae on the west Atlantic coast of Orkney. And part of the reason why people attach a great deal of importance to this material, both locally, in terms of the way that people think about the land and themselves, but also from the point of view of tourism, is that these buildings survive. And they often survive partly out of accidents, they've been buried by sandstorms and things like that, but also they survive because they're built in stone. And we kind of take that for granted. So what I want to try and do today is talk a bit about the relationship between people and stone in Orkney 5,000 years or so ago. And what I want to suggest is that that relationship is very specific, very particular, and very historical. The same bedrock, the Devonian sandstones that are about 350 to 400 million years old, which give Orkney its shape, continue through into northern Scotland. And yet many of the things that I'll show you in the next 25 minutes or so, you don't find anywhere else. So there is a specificity, a time and a place in which a particular relationship with stone develops and is pursued and changed and worked over the course of about 2,000 years. So what I want to try and talk about is, in Orkney, 5,000 years ago, how stoneworking becomes a particularly powerful discourse, a particularly powerful way in which people come to understand who they are, how they relate to other people, how they relate to place, and how they relate to the past. But what kind of world are we talking about? Well, we're talking largely about a world which was occupied, in human terms, by cattle farmers, by relatively small communities who lived in scattered farmsteads and small clusters of dwellings. There are no massive villages as such. There are no towns. This is long before the development of urbanism. So a small, scattered and fragmented landscape within islands and between islands. But it's not just a small world, a local world, because the people of that time were happy on land and at sea. And it's quite clear from a variety of lines of evidence that people were moving backwards and forwards between the islands of the archipelago, but they were also moving further afield, across to the continent, down the Irish Sea and across to Ireland, to the Western Isles of Scotland, and perhaps further afield as well. So there's a kind of a sense of overlapping worlds, of blurred and shifting boundaries, which modern politics, and certainly since the 18th century anyway, have tended to miss. There's a sort of blurring of connections at different scales, which is fundamental to understanding the way in which the archaeology works. Another thing that I think is really important to understand is that although much of our evidence tells us about relatively small communities of people, it isn't a simple egalitarian society that we're dealing with. Think perhaps about something like the Norse period, the Vikings. This is a period of very volatile politics in which a huge amount is invested in kinship, who you're related to, who you're descended from, who you can espouse connections with. But it's also a period of time in which people compete for authority, for renown, for prestige. And that's a very volatile quality, something that you can gain, but it's also something you can lose. And that's fundamental to the way in which life plays out between different communities at the time. And it's into that rather complex and dynamic world that I want to think about stone. And it's in the Neolithic that we first see people building in Orkney using the local bedrock. And the very first structures that people construct, the very first things that they build, are tombs, houses for the dead, places in which the remains of people are placed and sometimes reorganized and reworked over time. And there are many, many tombs across Orkney. This is the interior of one called Blackhammer. As far as we can tell, most of these burial grounds, these tombs, are constructed by people who live within particular neighborhoods, not necessarily just one community and one farm, but several different farming communities who perhaps occupy half of a bay or, you know, a side of a hill. And they come together to construct these monuments that have a local communal significance. And we're beginning to see that now in the DNA that's being extracted from some of the bones that have been taken from these places. So these operate above the level of a farm. They serve as a focal point for community memory within a particular neighborhood area. And that's why perhaps there are so many of them. What we can see when we look at the architecture of these places is several different qualities that I think are pertinent to the discussions we're having today and tomorrow. The first is you can see that when you go from one island to another, you look at tombs and you can recognize that they are all related. They have similar kinds of architectural motifs in their construction. Each one is unique in a fairly trivial sense of the word. Each one does vary, so there are local ways of doing things, but they would all be recognized as tombs. The amount of labor that's involved in putting these things together is really quite substantial. And so you get a sense that the physical act of building is a collective activity, something that would involve a considerable commitment of labor. These were places that mattered to people, which is why they would put so much time into them. What we see emerging over the course of the Neolithic is that the building of tombs becomes a focus for something really quite dramatic, in which it's not just the amount of effort that you put into creating somewhere where you can place your dead and focus on the memory of those people, but building itself and skilled selection of stone, the skilled setting and placement of stone to to create this architecture becomes really important in its own right. These places can become, and certainly not as time passes, they become incredibly elaborate, really well put together. So skilled stoneworking is itself a valuable practice. Now, as far as we can tell, tombs primarily serve as a technology of memory. They are a place that is constructed in order to provide a focus for people's ideas about how they're connected to each other, how they're connected to land, with reference to an ancestral past, to the names, the memories of the people who are contained within that tomb. But there's something else as well, because many of these tombs are built and then reworked and refashioned over time. The architecture is sometimes made far more elaborate. This is one called Midhow. I put this picture in, it's my favorite site in Orkney, mostly for the metalwork on top, which is just stunning to walk over. It's got over 3,500 bolts in it. I counted them, I am that sad. It was just all those physical actions going in into putting it together. It's kind of an equivalent for the work that goes on beneath it. What you see in these places is a real intelligence of the hand. There is really strongly embodied skill in selecting stone, drawing it from a quarry without it breaking and shattering, and then placing it to construct these particular monuments. There's a huge amount of knowledge which it takes years to develop in order to construct one of these things. As far as we can tell, again, because evidence does change, the first houses that people lived in, houses for the living, were constructed out of earth and timber. But when people start to build with stone, the houses in which they live, the form, the footprint, and the architectural arrangement of space in those stone buildings is an equivalent for what we find in tombs. So people are making the same kinds of architectural choices inspired by a memorial architecture which has been around for some time. Again, there's a quality here that if you were to walk, if you were allowed, into a house on one island as opposed to another, you would recognize the layout. There are particular arrangements and orientations, central hearths, you can see one in the middle of this picture here, which are fundamental to the way in which these things are laid out. There'll be little details which vary from one site to another and from one island to another. But if you want to have an architecture which says something about the connections that extend beyond the local community, this does it. A very, very strong conformity to a plan. On most of the dwellings that we find across Neolithic Orkney, all of the stone that's built, all the stone that's used, is found locally. People basically work with rock that is ready to hand, and they work with it very skillfully to put together buildings which have very, very striking architectural characteristics. One of the other things that we tend to find is that as time passes, an existing building becomes a focus for further buildings. Oh yeah, I should say actually, in some cases, they don't really have foundations as we would understand the term. But in this particular case, what you're looking at on this picture is the foundation layer for this house on an island called Westray in northern Orkney was about 30 cattle skulls, all with their horns interlocking, forming a continuous line that went round the base, and then they built the wall on top of that. If this is a world where people identify with and through their cattle, with their herds, to make such an extraordinary, conspicuous act of deposition at the start of the build of a house is to make a fairly powerful statement. But you get little clues that it's the persistence of certain things over time that really matters. In quite a lot of the settlement sites that we've got, this is an example from Scarra Brae, you find that buildings are built, maintained, they start to fall over, they're rebuilt. Sometimes the walls are completely removed and a new lot of walls are put in. But the one thing that remains constant is the hearth, the fire at the center of the house. Those hearths are set and set again on top of each other, so that even though the outward configuration of a building sometimes changes completely, the position of the hearth is absolutely constant. And it may not be accidental that in the sort of folk memory of Orcadian communities, the one thing that people go on about more than anything else is keeping the fire going, which is kind of important, certainly in the winter. So there's these fixed points of reference which tie you back, even in domestic space, to the past. And then you get this strong sense, this a plan of Scarra Brae, superimposed on a photograph of Vere Gordon Child working on the site in the 1920s and 30s, of houses that are clustered together, the physical proximity of buildings, a way of giving strong architectural expression through the building processes itself, as well as the living, of a sense of community. And then we get to something very different. We're back to the place that I showed you a picture of right at the beginning, the Stennis Brodgar area, but from a different angle. We're looking west, and we're looking at the narrow isthmus of land between the two locks. What makes this area interesting is that whilst much of the architecture of the tombs and the settlements speaks of relatively small communities, neighbourhoods and so on, this particular area is a place which brings a much bigger world into focus. These are the landscapes where we tend to find the largest ceremonial monuments, places that drew people together from across the archipelago of Orkney, but also brought in people from Ireland, possibly from the continent, and certainly from southern Britain, for particularly important events, collective ceremonies, feasting, the whole world socially and politically drawn in close at certain times. I mean, evidence for one feast that we've got at one of the sites I'm digging at the moment is 400 cattle in one barbecue. I'm sure we'll have a lovely dinner tonight, but I mean, the scale of consumption as a very important, powerful statement in its own right is sometimes really difficult to get your head around. But the key thing is, in this particular landscape, the world has been drawn in close. And you can see that again in the stone, because this, sitting at the heart of this landscape, is a site called the Ring of Brodgar. And you can just pick out, there's a series of standing stones forming a circle. Originally, there were 60 of them. When you look at the lithology of the stone, although they're all bedrock from Orkney, they all come from different areas. So you've got people dragging, it's a really performative form of active, remembering who you are and how you're connected. You're creating connections by drawing these huge, sometimes they're 4 to 5 meters tall slabs of stone, actually very fragile, easily broken in half. Some of them have been dragged 4, 5, even 10 kilometers over rough terrain to be placed and erected in this circle. So you've got these different places being brought together, large chains of people dragging these things across the landscape in different directions. And this is also the same landscape in which you get the most extravagant architecture of all. This, perhaps one of the most dramatic tombs known in Orkney, this is Maze Howe, and the light coming down from the passage, I don't know why I'm pointing there, in the middle, is the light that shines down an 11 meter long passage at midwinter. So it's aligned on astronomical events. But you get not only monumental tombs, but monumental settlements. Places like this, Barnhouse, and others, where building those traditions that people have maintained across many, many generations are taken to a new level and drawn on in new and very dramatic ways. And this is a site where we kind of first met, although I wasn't aware that you were there. I should say, when I got my invitation, I got this little film that had been taken of me, just drawing and staring and standing and not doing very much. And it was partly because you sent me the pictures that I agreed to come. But my children have just laughed so much because, "You're not doing anything, Dad. You're not doing anything at all." But then they think that anyway. This is a site called the Ness of Brodgar. It's on this very narrow strip of land. And it's, as an archaeologist, but I think even for people who aren't archaeologists, it's really difficult to get your head around. There's 100, 120 buildings. Many of them are on top of one building, which is on top of another building. And I think the longest sequence, maybe 3, could even be more. the buildings, but I mean, just on a monumental scale. There's nothing else that we've so far excavated anywhere in Orkney like it. Again, there are forms to the architecture which would be familiar to anybody coming to the place from another settlement in Orkney. But here, they're taken to ridiculous extremes, monumental extremes. The buildings are much, much bigger. They're far bigger than anything you'd find on other settlements at the time. And they're built on top of each other, as I mentioned before. You can see different layers to the buildings as you go down. And they're built to make a very dramatic statement or a series of dramatic statements. These are just examples that we've been working on. First of all, there's the selection of the stone that's involved. These buildings are created by bringing together really carefully quarried stone from very particularly selected quarries. And then that stone is worked with a really high level of skill. So there's something that's beyond the level that we would normally see in most of the settlements. Yeah, I mean, basically, people will work with whatever stone's available on most of the settlements. Here at the Nessa Brogga, only certain kinds of stone will do. Most of these buildings, some of them are nearly 25 metres in length. I mean, and they have walls that are 4 or 5 metres thick. And they're roofed with stone, which is, again, something that's unusual. You wouldn't see that on most of the other settlements. And to create a stone roof for one of these buildings, you have to rive, which is basically like working slate. You have to split this material into really thin slabs. And some of the slabs would be about that long. It's really hard to do. It's something that takes years to really get on top of. And it's certainly a skill that, as far as we can tell, is being handed on across generations, which again is a theme that runs through a lot of the stoneworking there. So this is a departure from the everyday, but a very dramatic statement. And you see it inside the buildings as well, where not only have you got really carefully selected stone, but you have stone that's been brought in from great distances, which is then used to create particular kinds of decorative forms inside. So you get the coursing of different colours of stone along the walls, or they're carved in bas-relief or with inscription to create particular kinds of visual effects. Skillful working, a kind of rhetoric of raw materials that is fundamental to getting across the idea that these buildings are special, these buildings are important. And you can see it even with the exterior walls. These are basically places that have been built, they've been dressed to impress. They're buildings that make a statement. They make a statement about the people who are building them, or perhaps more importantly, the people who are in charge of the process of building. I doubt for a moment that this is all about celebrating the work of masons, although those masons are indeed very, very skilled. This is architecture as a form of rhetoric, which is linked at that time in that place to ideas about authority and renown and prestige. And over the course of something like, so far, at least 1,500 years at that site, the Nessa Brogga, one of the things that we find is a really interesting tension. Because on the one hand, what you'll find is that people are constructing really elaborate, monumental houses or halls to draw people in, to have feasts and so on and so forth. But they're doing it on top of other buildings. So you've got a sense of the reiterative use of this place, drawing attention to connections across time, trying to ground whatever it is that you're doing in a sense of connections to the past, laying claim to the past. This is right at the heart of the landscape that draws people in from all over the known world at that time. And so if you're able to build something on top of and show a connection to the past and all that it stands for, that becomes a very powerful ideological device. But the buildings themselves aren't necessarily concerned with that. Not to the same extent, I mean, not as we might think about it. And certainly it resonates with something that Eric was saying earlier on, because almost all these buildings don't have foundations. They may have cuttle skulls, but they don't have what we would call a foundation. And one of the consequences of that, especially when you put a huge roof on the top, is that they start to fall over. So they may have walls that are 4, 5 metres thick. They may stretch for 20, 25 metres. But once they're put up, they start to fall down. And they can start to fall down quite quickly. And I think what's really important about that, and something that the heritage industry, particularly in Britain, misses is we now, as an institution, place a value on these things because they're old and because they've survived. But they were never built with that in mind. They were built to serve particular purposes for the moment, for an event. I think it's kind of interesting that from what we can tell from our work on the site, and there's many people involved, is that these things basically had a lifetime, the buildings had a lifetime of about a generation, maybe two, which might tell you something about the kind of temporality of political ambition, if you like. And that falling apart, not collapsing buildings, may actually be a really important part of the story. So when it comes to thinking about conservation on this site, are we really telling an important part of the story by making these things last forever? I'm not sure that we are necessarily. Because one of the things that I think is telling and fascinating about these sites, and this is really the last point I want to make, is that for all the work that went into them, by the time you get to the end of the Neolithic, they disappear. Basically, people stop using them, they stop occupying them, they all fall down, they eventually become covered with soil, and they are forgotten about. There is nothing in the subsequent period, the Bronze Age, to indicate that many of these places continue to have a hold on people's imaginations. It's only 2,000 years later, 100 generations or more, that people start to come back to these Neolithic sites. And it's in the Iron Age that that happens, what we call the Iron Age. This is not a photograph of the Iron Age. This was taken in the very early 20th century when people were re-erecting some of the stones at another site called the Stones of Stennis. But what happens in the Iron Age, 800, 500 BC, and then for a few centuries, is you see people going back to Neolithic sites. They start to build on top of them. They build houses into the fabric of tombs. They reuse stone from Neolithic sites. They copy Neolithic architectural motifs, architectural forms, not because the stone dictates that that's how it has to be worked, but because they are picking up on the choices that have been made at what we would see as a distant remove. Now, these kinds of connections that people are making in the Iron Age are so specific and so powerful that it raises the question of what kind of memory is at work here. I think over a period of 2,000 years in an oral culture where architecture, portable objects are really important as devices for remembering, even though that may be the case, 2,000 years is quite a struggle. So I think what we're dealing with here is people relating to a past, but a past that's not, as we might understand it, history or genealogy or memory, but a past as myth, in which genealogies may well be being claimed and asserted, but they are more fictive than real. And on that note, I shall stop, if that's okay.